Welcome to the 107th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. Welcome. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Happy Valentine's Day. It's a couple days early, but we're going to try to have a Valentine's Day podcast. It's also American Heart Month. It's also Go Red for Women Month. In the past, I've had a little difficulty with Valentine's days. It's kind of everything that can go wrong does go wrong, and this one is summing up to be probably similar. I'm on my third attempt at this podcast due to some technical difficulty, so I hope that it comes across loud and clear and everything's okay. I'd like to dedicate this podcast to my grandmothers. Both died of heart disease. One at a very young age of 56 with complications of diabetes and heart disease. And I remember going to the hospital, riding in the back of a car, taking her to the hospital in heart failure when I was little and spending time in the waiting room. And my other grandmother died much too young of an acute myocardial infarction just shortly after Christmas. And I still remember the symptoms that she had was she thought she had the flu, and she kept saying, if I could just burp or if I could just belch. And those symptoms always stuck with me because typically women don't necessarily have the same signs and symptoms of a heart attack as men do. And that's one reason for the American Heart Go Red Month is to bring awareness of heart disease in women. The reality of it is that 1 in 3 women die of heart disease. And 44 million women are affected. I don't know about you, but when, as a woman, breast cancer was always the thing that kind of scared me or scares me the most. And that incidence is about a 1 in 9 incidence. So a 1 in 3 incidence from heart disease, it's much greater. 90% of women have more than one risk factor for heart disease. And risk factors for heart disease include smoking, hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, and a family history. More women than men have a stroke. Fewer women survive their first heart attack. Again, oftentimes because the symptoms are more subtle, overwhelming fatigue, flu-like symptoms, just an uncomfortable feeling, they may ignore. You know, my grandmother ignored that feeling for a couple days before she was actually admitted with acute heart attack that left her with heart block and death in 2 or 3 days. If you look at the African American population over 20 years of age, 48% have cardiovascular disease. And, you know, typically we see hypertension much more prevalent in African Americans, and they can actually develop a very thick heart muscle much quicker. That leads to decreased blood flow to the heart and in coronary artery disease. And screening in this population is much less than, you know, in other populations. So it's very important that we bring awareness of the risk factors for coronary artery disease and cardiovascular disease. The American Heart Association says on their website that 80% of cardiovascular events can be prevented by lifestyle change. 80%. If you talk to Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, and I agree with him, probably over 90% can be avoided. It blows my mind to see that they say that 80% can be prevented with lifestyle changes, yet we don't ever address lifestyle changes in the general practice of medicine. We suggest people get stress tests and echocardiograms, and we watch their hypertension and we watch their cholesterol, but we don't ever address the lifestyle changes that they can make to reverse or eliminate the need for high blood pressure, eliminate the need for diabetes, eliminate the high cholesterol. So, you know, we have all these great campaigns and people, you know, sign up for 5Ks and they raise money for the American Heart Association, and they're doing research for the cure when 80% can be reversed. And I'm going to repeat it over and over again because it's such a simple reversal. It is to reverse diabetes, hypertension, and hyperlipidemia. And it all can be reversed with a whole food, plant-based diet. When I was in medical school, we were told that women didn't really have to worry about coronary artery disease until after menopause. And then after menopause, their risk approached that of men. That wasn't really true then. You know, the exception was always if women smoked or if they had diabetes, then that changed that rule. And if you look now, there are so many women that are overweight, that have diabetes and hypertension at a young age, that, you know, the possibilities of having a myocardial infarction are very real in their 30s. Even way back when I was in med school, I had a patient that had a bypass at age 32. So people, and especially women, can't assume just because they're young they don't have coronary artery disease. And in fact, even looking at men that were casualties of war, there was already plaque in their arteries. And those plaques are dangerous when it comes to an acute event, because the cholesterol in those plaques can be like little sharp crystals that can pierce through the plaque and cause a reaction where a blood clot forms and a heart attack happens. And that's how people have, you know, what is called the big one, and they have sudden death and they die on the spot because there's a sudden abrupt decrease of blood flow to a major area of the heart that results in arrhythmia and sudden death. Just last week in a local half marathon, there was a death of a 30-year-old. And you see that there's actually more deaths in half marathons than marathons and Ironman races, partly because of the greater numbers participating in these events. But, you know, this event is attracted because it's a, you know, it has that name of a marathon. It's a half marathon, but it's not quite thought of as being quite as grueling or taxing on the body. So people that aren't nearly as well trained as they should be or in as good a health as they should be tackle this 13.1-mile race and can get into really big troubles. If you take the data that I just presented you with 30-year-olds having significant plaques in their arteries, and then you add, you know, the other risk factors, and then all of a sudden they decide that they're going to run a half marathon and they start this training, you know, it really is dangerous when you think about it. And it's a wonder that there's not more events that happen, and maybe there are and not quite reported. But you know, I really do believe that people in that age group should have their cholesterol checked and their blood pressure checked and these risk factors addressed before they start in something as taxing as a half marathon. Certainly, they shouldn't start training for it unless they're also training with their nutrition plan. And I think that's something that we don't stress near enough. If you go to these events, you know, before and after, there's food that's bad all over the place. You know, there's the peanut butter and the danishes and the hot dogs even. You know, my first 5-mile race was Bill's Beer Run, and the finish line had hot dogs and beer. And there were people that were actually competing in the race just because there was beer and hot dogs. And you know, as that, the hot dogs part is probably a little bit more uncommon, but the cheese pizza and the donuts and the you know, all that kind of stuff is very prevalent at finish lines. There are oftentimes people that are doing the race just in order to get together and go to breakfast and have this big bulky breakfast afterwards. So you can see, if you think about the whole mechanism, you're going to stress your heart, and then you're going to go eat something that causes a blood vessel to constrict for 6 hours. It's a recipe for disaster. The other thing that's more prevalent these days is that metabolic syndrome or glucose intolerance or borderline diabetes. You know, these are all kind of grayed in together in this pre-diabetic syndrome, where people have a larger waist than hips, which is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease because abdominal fat is associated with more estrogen, which causes more insulin-like growth factor release. And, you know, plaque formation, the abdominal fat also obviously is associated with visceral fat, which leads to glucose intolerance. So these people have high cholesterol, glucose intolerance, and oftentimes high blood pressure. but not frank diabetes. But the reality of it is the risk for cardiovascular disease and peripheral vascular disease is there. So it's a real worry in this age population. You know, I'm not saying that people shouldn't partake in these events, but, you know, I think that we need to raise awareness that, you know, it's great you're participating in these events, but let's address the whole health factor. You know, let's get their nutrition under control as well. So what are the warning signs of heart disease in women? Certainly that overwhelming fatigue is something to be concerned about. You know, I always ask my patients over the last 6 months, have you had a decline in energy? Is it more difficult for you to get done what you need to do now than it was then? Do you have to take naps? Are you going to bed early? Are you sleeping less? You know, those are all risk factors for ongoing disease. You know, the traditional chest discomfort, which is in the central part of the chest that comes on with exertion at first and then is relieved with rest, you know, that doesn't necessarily always occur with women. Sometimes it can be jaw discomfort that comes on with exertion and goes away with rest, or left arm discomfort. Angina pain typically is short lasting at first. It's 5 minutes or less. It's with the activity, then goes away with rest. It may start to come on with less and less exertion. So it may have been previously with going up a ladder or vigorous walking, and then it goes down to just making the bed or carrying in groceries, and then it can occur at rest. And in the most dangerous point, if it occurs at rest or wakes somebody up from sleep, that's a sign that their heart's not getting enough blood, even in a resting state. So certainly, you know, if you have exertional angina, it should be evaluated up front. But if it gets to the point where it's happening at rest, you actually need to go to the emergency room. What about testing? You know, it's often there's trucks that come by and test carotids and do echoes. You know, how do they really help? Do they pick up things and do they pick up disease in the absence of symptoms, or do they find disease that leads to more tests? You know, for starters, you know, there's still nothing that beats a physical exam. If you have a murmur, then I think it's worth having an echocardiogram. If there's been some palpitations or dizziness, I think it's worth having an echocardiogram. And that's an ultrasound of the heart to look at the valves and look at the overall heart, the structure of the heart and the function of the heart currently. You know, as far as a stress test, it's a good way to assess someone's functional capacity, meaning how far you can walk on a stress test. And there's protocols, and the typical protocol we use is called a Bruce protocol. And if you've ever had a stress test, every 3 minutes the treadmill incline goes up as well as the speed, and starts out at a very slow walk and a minimal incline and continues to go up every 3 minutes. And that is gauged for different activity levels. So if you can only walk 3 minutes on a Bruce protocol, that's the equivalent of making your bed. On the contrary, if you can walk 10 minutes on a Bruce protocol, that's the equivalent of shoveling snow or digging a hole. So if someone has a regular treadmill test and a normal electrocardiogram, and they can go 10 minutes without any EKG changes and without any arrhythmias, then their chances of having an event that's lethal in the near future is low. If you add nuclear imaging to that, it sometimes clouds the picture, especially in the light of no symptoms. So if people aren't having any symptoms, then we have to assess their pre-test probability. So do they have risk factors of smoking and diabetes and fatigue? Then that would increase the pre-test probability. So with the stress test with nuclear imaging, we it would be more accurate than just to test everybody that comes into the office. So unless you have symptoms, to do a stress test for an asymptomatic patient is probably not warranted. If you're looking to assess the functional capacity of a patient, then that is warranted. Calcium score looks at the calcium in arteries. If you have calcium in your coronary arteries, you're more likely to have significant blockages. On the contrary, you can have significant blockages and not have calcium in the arteries. And most of the calcified arteries are more of the chronic narrowings that are probably not going to rupture like a soft plaque would anyway. So it's somewhat controversial. It does define that people have coronary artery disease of some degree. If they're not having any symptoms, again, the best way to address this is to get rid of their cardiovascular risk factors. So is their cholesterol high? Fix it. Do they have diabetes? Fix it. Do they have hypertension? Then let's fix it. Not treat it, but fix it. Reverse it through a whole food plant-based nutrition. Remember, treating with medications of any of these diseases is not going to significantly reverse the process. So taking cholesterol medications may decrease your risk a few percentage, but it's not going to be protective because that process will continue. The same way with hypertension. The blood pressure risk of a stroke is decreased slightly by taking the blood pressure medications. But the reason you have high blood pressure in the first place because of an abnormal blood vessel, because of a lack of endothelial nitric oxide production, is not being addressed by blood pressure medication. So it's not going to be protective. So if you take cholesterol medication and you take blood pressure medication and you run a marathon, you're not protected from a stroke, a heart attack, or sudden death because it does nothing to prevent the ischemic process from progressing. The other fallacy that we have is that you can out-exercise your cardiovascular disease. If you start training for the 5K or the half marathon, then you can reverse your coronary artery disease. And that simply isn't true. You make your body more efficient at using oxygen. It improves your muscle tone. It's good for you. Certainly the walking helps. But it is not going to reverse your cholesterol, and it's not going to decrease your overall risk of heart disease. So, again, nutrition needs to be addressed. There was a study that looked at exercising for an hour and a half vigorously a day, followed by sitting the rest of the day, and there was an increased mortality. So, you know, just because we go to the gym and do our workouts and then spend the rest of the day in chair, we're not really protected. You're a little bit more protected if you're eating right. But, and when I say right, a whole food plant-based diet. So what about that box of chocolate for Valentine's Day? My father used to bring home a large Russell Stover Valentine's heart-shaped box of chocolate that you see in the drugstores to my mother and myself every year for Valentine's Day. And that was very special because it was one of the only holidays that he actually did the shopping. I think it had something to do with he really liked the chocolates as well. But nevertheless, he would bring these box of chocolates home, and so that's a traditional thing. So what about, you know, is it wrong to buy people a box of chocolates for Valentine's Day? You know, certainly these large, giant boxes with all these goofy flavors are just full of sugar. There's really not much in the way of chocolate. It's fat and chemicals, you know, in this stuff. If you're going to buy somebody chocolates, you're better off buying some really good dark piece of chocolate for them. On the other hand, if they're a diabetic or struggling with their weight or struggling to convert to being plant-based, then, you know, maybe a nice dinner at a vegan restaurant would be a better option for a gift or some other kind of gift. You know, I think we need to start, you know, again, marketing. Think outside the box. If you go into any Walgreens or CVS or any other store, I was in Walmart. I mean, any place. There are actually literally rows of Valentine's Day candies and chocolates that has just become synonymous with Valentine's Day. And it's kind of ironic, if we're going to show people how much we love them, we try to give them food that's, you know, potentially going to cause them to have a heart attack or accelerate the process of cardiovascular disease. Interestingly, if you cut a strawberry lengthwise, so vertically, it forms a perfect heart. So a nice dessert with strawberries is a great alternative. in my nutrition class, the last class is dessert night. It's a graduation. We do a final exam, and I bring desserts. And most of the time, actually all the time, I bring a healthy dessert. Joel Fuhrman's books have great desserts that are made with fruit. There can be some pieces of chocolate in them, but most of them are made with nuts and fruit, and right, just the right amount without added sugar, certainly without any oil. He has a healthy chocolate cake that even has beets and carrots and zucchini in it. You can't taste that. You just taste the cacao powder. When you cook with cacao powder or you use cacao powder in dessert, you know, that is the cocoa bean or the without all any of the oils or liquors or fat solids that they add to it to make chocolate. So it has a lot of antioxidants and flavonoids that are actually protective. So chocolate in itself is fine. It's just when they add all the other liquors to it that and butterfat and milk fat that starts to make it really bad. And sugars. And that's what you see in all these processed, refined Valentine's Day gifts. The other thing that I find in the final exam was that people know the answers to the science questions that I ask them, such as, you know, what are the vegetables that produce nitric oxide when they mix with your saliva? And of course, the answer to that is spinach, kale, collards, mustard greens, beet tops, beet greens, broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower. You know, those are the things that we want people to eat 4 cups of a day to produce nitric oxide. They know the answer to that, and they know the answer to the supplement they need is B12, and they know the answer to eat beans to increase the fiber. But yet when I talk to them after class, a lot of people still have trouble implementing that in their cooking. This past class, I had probably 50% that were completely on board had switched, but I continue to have a 10% or so that just can't get it started. I had one patient in particular that is really ill. He really needs to change. He has multiple risk factors. He's young. He's what you call a heart attack waiting to happen. He knew all the answers to the question yet had not implemented them. His excuse was that he's ridding his house of the other things first and that he's making some things, but, you know, not really. He's implemented the oatmeal and blueberries. So it's a small, you know, he's done some small steps, but not near what he needs to. The last class, I also brought one of my first success stories in. This patient I've taken care of for over 20 years, and I took care of his wife. She actually had died of fatty liver. They both had bypass surgeries. He had taken his medications on and off for the, you know, past 10 years. I'd kind of lose him to follow up, and then he'd show up, and his blood pressure would be high, and he'd start taking his meds. He'd start taking his blood pressure meds, and he'd start taking his cholesterol meds. He kind of studied for his test. Right before his blood work, he'd take the cholesterol medicines for a couple months, and his blood work would be okay. Then he would stop him and back and forth. And, you know, the reality of it is he just didn't like the medications. But finally, he came in, and he was in heart failure with legs swollen, shortness of breath. He was having chest discomfort. He couldn't walk anymore. A quarter of a mile, he would get chest discomfort. And I actually did a heart catheterization to see what we were dealing with, and one of his bypass grafts was blocked, and that same artery was blocked. So he had nearly absence of any significant blood flow to the back of his heart, and that's where the chest pain was coming from. So I talked to he and his daughters who were with him about adopting a whole food plant-based diet, and they all got on board. They all bought the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease book and the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease cookbook, and they shared recipes. And you know, they said in class, you know, when we talked, that they went home that night from the office and they just cleaned out their cabinets. They cleaned things out, and right then and there, 100% crossed over to a whole food plant-based diet. Now, were they completely perfect at first? No, because it was a learning process as far as some processed food. But they did really good, and they basically aimed to get rid of anything in a box. If it's processed, if they thought it was processed in any way, they didn't eat it. And it resulted in significant weight loss, about 40 pounds weight loss for the patient, as well as a couple of his daughters. Their cholesterol normalized. The biggest thing in a few days, his chest pain went away. back to walking. Energy is great, and they're still doing it. You know, one of the reasons for his success, he was backed against the wall. The other one was he had tremendous family support. But they recognized the need to make a change. And I think one of the biggest things is they had strong convictions that they wanted to make a change, and they wanted their dad to get healthy, and they were willing to do anything they needed to do to accomplish it. And, you know, we talked about that in class, that, you know, you can make gradual changes, and it's often debated in podcasts. I'm sure a lot of people out there listen to podcasts about simple, small steps and gradual change, and nobody does everything all at once. But the reality of it is, if people are really ill, they need to make the biggest change possible in order to get the best benefit. And, you know, I think the more you can change, the quicker you can change, the healthier you feel, the more energy you have to look for ways to make more change. The more you change your gut flora, that helps to change your craving, the more your taste buds change. So I really do think that you're better off to kind of go for it and to go completely as opposed to these small steps, because you really fall off the wagon after a while with the small steps. Unless the only other alternative that I can see is a game plan, so that you really map it out like you're training for an event, and the final goal is to be 100% plant-based with no added oil, and you map out your six-month roadmap to get there. You know, that would be one approach, that you're really going to stick to this process, and you have somebody to help you keep accountable, because it's too easy to fall back. You know, anybody that smokes, if they, you know, they never quit smoking by just cutting back. They may get down to five or six cigarettes and they hold there, or something bad happens and they're back to smoking again. I've not talked to a patient yet that went down to a half pack, a quarter pack, three cigarettes, and then stopped. It just doesn't happen, because any stressor, any event that contributes to a bad behavior will result in that bad behavior starting again. You know, same way with sweets. Most, you know, there are people that can stay out of the sweets, and if the ability to just have one is very, very difficult. And it starts that whole process of getting back into, you know, going down the wrong road of eating bad things. So I really think that you need to put some boundaries on your conversion to a whole food, plant-based way of eating. I understand that you might not achieve everything at first, but I think if you don't have that goal and set the bar high enough, that you know you're underestimating your ability to help yourself. I had an Ironman athlete that's in her 70s come into my office, and she's not 100% plant-based. She's vegetarian. She does not eat dairy. I'm not sure about the amounts entirely of fish. I don't believe there's chicken. But she was worried about eating kale and cruciferous vegetables because of hurting her thyroid. She was told, and she read that eating kale was bad for her thyroid. The truth of the matter is that the kale produces goitrogenic chemicals that can affect the thyroid gland, but it affects them if there's no iodine, or there's not enough iodine. And eating raw cruciferous vegetables is slightly worse, because those chemicals are deactivated by cooking. But you would still need 3 pounds or 15 cups of some of these vegetables a day to cause a problem. So in reality, most people are not going to eat the amount of kale. The 4 cups that we're suggesting is not the 15 cups that can cause a problem. And ways to get iodine in your diet: too much iodine can be just as bad as not enough. But sea vegetables are a great way to get iodine in your diet. For starters, the Eden brand of canned beans is cooked with a sea vegetable, wakame. And that gives you your plenty of iodine. If you have iodinized salt, table salt in your food or exposed to that, then that gives you a plenty source of iodine. And we want people to avoid salt. So if they're not using any salt at all, then these sea vegetables are a great way to avoid, you know, or to help get your iodine. The reason why iodinized salt, iodine, it has its regular table salt has iodine added to it. There's also iodine in cow's milk, and that's because there's disinfectants into the cow's milk because of all the bacteria, and that's the source of iodine. So if that doesn't gross you out and keep you from drinking cow's milk, I don't know what. But again, the best source for iodine is sea vegetables. And there's probably, also advantage with the sea vegetables as far as cancer prevention, especially liver cancer. We're looking for 150 micrograms a day of iodine. And there are sea vegetables include dulse, flakes, kelp, laver, alera. There's one sea vegetable called hishiki, and it's spelled H-I-Z-I-K-I. You want to avoid that because it takes up arsenic that's in the oceans. But other than that, you know, so when I'm cooking, I may put a little wakame, it's W-A-K-A-M-E, in the beans themselves to cook them. I do my tuno, which has some dulse flakes sprinkled onto that. I also like sushi, that either I make sushi and roll it with cucumber, pepper, avocado, and cabbage, or I do the sushi bowl, so I'll just tear up the sheet of nori in my salad. So that's a good way. You know, a lot of supermarkets nowadays will have plant-based or vegetable sushi that you can get. So, you know, one day a week or so to have a sushi roll is a great way to get some iodine and to get your anti-cancer sea vegetables in. When the other thing that nitrates and these nitrate vegetables help with, they boost the mitochondrial function, and those are the powerhouses in your muscle cells. And it actually slows metabolism by about 4%. And you panic when you first hear that. It's like, oh, my metabolism's going to be slowed. I'm trying everything to boost my metabolism, not slow my metabolism. Fasting also slows your metabolism. But slowing your metabolism is also associated with longevity because, you know, it's just like a burning flame. Like Elton John says, you know, a candle burning in the wind. So if you're burning at a rapid rate, you're going to burn out. So you want your metabolism to be conservative. So eating these nitric oxide producing vegetables will slow your metabolism. They looked at 62,106 Japanese people from age 40 to 79 years of age, and they lived a healthy lifestyle, meaning they ate their greens, they didn't smoke, they walked at least an hour a day, and they slept at least 6.5 to 7.5 hours a day, and their BMI was normal range of 18 to 24.9. And they had a much lower incidence of heart disease. And if you do one, and they looked, in, if you did one of these, you would cut your risk of dying of heart disease by 25%. So go to back over and eat your greens, don't smoke, walk at least an hour a day and get adequate sleep and keep your BMI 18 to 24. You can decrease your risk of cardiovascular disease. So that's a good way to think about, you know, your risk factors. How hard is it to add the greens to your diet? You know, again, one of my suggestions is to take a couple handfuls of spinach and just microwave it for about 2 minutes and add it to whatever meal you're having for lunch. So it could be at the bottom of the soup that you're having. It could be just the bed of anything that you're eating. And it goes down to hardly anything. You know, it kind of probably is not even a half a cup of spinach once you microwave it. And it's so easy to get down. And then that's 2 cups down and in for you. You know, the same thing can be done at dinner. So if it has to be taken as medicine, take it as medicine. The nutrition professor, Timmery Hagenberger, I love what she says when she talks about cutting things up like confetti, so that you cut things up very, very small and that you get a bite of everything. So you're getting your greens in. So even if people are a little finicky about their cabbage or their kale and not wanting to chew it and it being, you know, feeling like they're having to cut through all this fiber, if it's chopped up in very small pieces, they get a lot of different flavors. And, you know, it goes down a lot easier. Speaking of Timory, we're going to start doing a monthly podcast together. So I hope in the next couple of weeks we have that up. So we're trying to get some ideas to help. We can take our challenges and put them together to help people out there with their challenges. And I guess when we get back to Valentine's Day, and I said things go wrong for me at Valentine's Day, there's also things that go really right. And of course, when you look back on things that go wrong and looking in the rearview mirror, they're always funny things that go wrong, and they make for good stories. But I think, you know, taking Valentine's Day and showing compassion for another individual or helping out or a little pat on the back or a little shake an extra hand or say good morning to a extra person can really go a long way to making you feel good on Valentine's Day. It doesn't have to be, you know, the best relationship that you have in the world, or if you're having a bad relationship, it doesn't have to be all about that. It can be just kindness and love toward another human being, or, you know, even your companion animals. So I hope that this Valentine's Day, the social media overwhelming of what marketing means to Valentine's Day doesn't overwhelm you, and that you can use it as a day to be kind and compassionate to another individual and interact with somebody, because that's also a means to longevity, is remaining socially interactive with other people and having a sense of purpose. And we all have a purpose, and it, you may think it's small, but it can be really big, just lightening up someone's day. I heard a story that a guy was driving a bus. And he retired from another job, but he started driving a school bus. And the kids would get on the bus, and nobody would speak, and they'd have their heads down in their cell phone. And he started saying good morning to each of them as they got on the school bus. And after a while, they started saying good morning back to him. And it was a bright aspect of his day and a bright aspect of their day, because there might have been, in the district that he picked up kids, people, they may have not had breakfast, and no one may have said anything to them that morning, but that's just that good morning changed their day and changed their attitude. So just remember, you can change somebody's day with a good morning or a kind word, and you can probably change it the other way by doing something nasty. So maybe think about that a little bit on Valentine's Day as well. I'm continuing to evolve. We do the six-week nutrition courses. We just finished one. We're going to jump right back in. We have a full class. One thing I've noticed is that 6 weeks give people an education so they can answer the questions right, but the implementation is still variable with some people. So my goal over the next year is to grow this nutrition class as more of a membership club, so that people can keep coming to class and have access to the class for 6 months or a year, however long it takes. Perhaps have different levels of classes. If you've listened to the podcast before, you know I'd like to do some raw food preparation. So there may be a class for preparing raw food, maybe, you know, different ethnic nights to extend the classes as far as more menus, perhaps more shopping to get people more involved and comfortable with shopping. So that's the plan. If you have any questions for me, please email me at jamiedulaney@gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. Please check out my website at drdulaney.com. That's spelled out. I do telemedicine conference calls, so I'm willing to speak with you about your nutrition, any game plan that you may have. If you're in the area and you'd like to come to class, please call. I'd love to have you in the class. And I look forward to speaking with you next week. So happy Valentine's Day. Make somebody's day a little brighter with just a hello, a smile, or a handshake. Try to stay away from the chemical-laden chocolates, and maybe go for a little piece of dark chocolate or a healthy dessert like Joel Fuhrman's healthy chocolate cake, or a big bowl of berries with some cashew cream made. So good luck with all that. Keep moving, keep mobile, and I'll talk to you next week.